Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 31st of December 1922, it's another special, and this time it's the railways. Not in this episode, because, well, it's a special. There was a lively correspondence about the lack of female domestic servants. The 36th Ulster Division got a history. The Ku Klux Klan thought about admitting Roman Catholics, and there was an article on unsolved murders, or the lack of them. Anyway, railways. A little bit of background here. Prior to 1914, the railways, well, there was more or less a free market when it came to railways, or as close to a free market as pretty much anyone's ever got. There were a few things. A few interventions. There were a few safety regulations. There was the accident investigations that the government undertook. There were such things as parliamentary trains, which pretty much every company had to run, which once a day at a rate of one penny a mile. There were a few bans on mergers, and every company needed an act of parliament in order to come into existence. Then the war happened, and the railway companies, being vital to the war effort, came under government control. Now, government control has persisted into the post-war period and came to an end, I think, at some point in 1921 or 22, I'm not quite sure which. And the railways are in a bad way. There has been very little investment in the previous 8 years, as you might expect. Yes, they have to keep up with maintenance, because otherwise the whole thing falls apart. But other than that, there's no investment in new technology or new lines or electrification, although a little bit of electrification did take place in London from Twickenham to Waterloo, opening in 1916 of all years. But otherwise, it's not great. To help out, or at least as the government thought to help out, what they've done is they've taken something like, I mean, it's tens, it may even be hundreds of railways or separate railway companies, and grouped them and forcibly merged them into four blocks. You may have heard of the London Midland and Scottish, the London North Eastern Railway, the Southern Railway, or the Great Western Railways. These are the four big ones. London Underground's is not part of this. Anyway, this is what the Times has to say about these arrangements. This is from Friday, the 29th of December. The object of the Act is to rescue the railways from the bankruptcy with which they were threatened as a result of the war, and to help them to become once more self-supporting commercial undertakings. Its main principle is that the charges are to be fixed by the Rates Tribunal, so as to yield an annual revenue equal to the aggregate net revenue of the companies in 1913. This provision, as was pointed out in our special railway number published in August last year, may amount really to a guarantee of the profits of the companies out of the pockets of their customers. If the return expected on the capital is not realised, it seems as though the companies might fairly claim an increase of the standard rates. If, on the other hand, the standard rates should be found to cripple trade and hamper competition with the country's foreign rivals, then there might have to be a call for revision in a different direction. That's not exactly a great incentive. You know, if you work hard, if you introduce new services, if you try to improve your services, you get a certain amount of money. And if you do none of those things, you get the same certain amount of money. So why try harder? Anyway, it goes on. With regard to the savings and economies which may be expected to result from the grouping system, which Sir Eric Geddes estimated at 20 millions per annum, it is impossible to make any confident prediction. But it is at all events reasonable to assume that they will in process of time reach a very considerable figure. Economies are bound to result from the simplification of through bookings on long train journeys, from the rearrangement of cross-country services, the pooling of passenger and goods rolling stock to cope with special emergencies, the standardisation of rolling stock and equipment, and other reforms of the grouping system. There's a lot in that paragraph. I think the first thing to say is that it's contrary to free market theory, and indeed free market practice. We see mergers happen in the private sector all the time. The reason being, in many cases, because it's more efficient. It's more efficient if company A takes over company B and there'll be economies of scale. And so the question becomes, why haven't mergers taken place in the railway industry if they will make those companies or the combined companies more profitable? I think the answer is either because the government says they can't. I believe the government actually specifically banned. There were two companies in the southeast of London. What were they? Were they South Eastern Railway and the London, Dover and Chatham, I think, or London, Chatham and Dover. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that, if I remember correctly, the government banned them from merging, although they had stations and lines in more or less the same places, and the competition between them was apparently ruinous, as a lot of books say. So there's regulation, and that may prevent a merger. Another reason is because it doesn't make any sense. For instance, you occasionally see the claim that the North London line, which it's in North London. Now, that was, as I understand it, an entirely independent line prior to grouping. It was taken over by the LMS, if my memory serves, and was severely run down as a consequence. There are situations in which a company will understand its route, its market better than a bigger company that takes it over. So it doesn't always work, a merger. On the other hand, this guy, Sir Eric Geddes, that they talk about, is not someone you can easily ignore. He started his career in the railway industry, and I think he rose to the general manager of the Great Northern. Now, the Great Northern would have been the company that ran trains from London to Newcastle, actually London to Edinburgh. And he then, in the war, they had severe problems with logistics on the Western Front, and he was sent out there. This was a Lloyd George appointment, and he was sent out there against the wishes of Douglas Haig, the commander-in-chief of the British forces, to reorganise the railways. And all accounts suggest he did a very good job of that. And then during the war, he became the First Lord of the Admiralty, and he seems to have done a very good job in terms of winning the U-boat war. And after the war, he was responsible for cutting a lot of government waste in, maybe 1921. So he's not someone you can easily ignore. So, I suppose there is something to be said. I mean, if he thought it was such a good idea, these mergers, why didn't he raise the money himself and merge these companies, as some people do? So do any of the Times's predictions come true? When it comes to the simplification of through bookings on long train journeys, I have absolutely no idea. Don't know. When it comes to the rearrangement of cross-country services, again, difficult to know. I wouldn't have thought so, just because most cross-country services, this is long distance, not involving London, would almost certainly have crossed more than one of the grouped railways. Then it says the pooling of passenger and goods rolling stock to cope with special emergencies. No idea. In fact, I wonder what they mean by special emergencies. I mean, the whole thing about railways, you want things to be very regular. You do not want an emergency on a railway. Things go horribly wrong when there are emergencies. And the standardisation of rolling stock and equipment, that really didn't happen. In fact, it didn't even happen under nationalisation. If you want to see good standardisation of rolling stock, go to Japan, where the electricity supply, the loading gauges, the track gauges, even the couplings are standard, despite the fact there are many, many railways involved. The fact they are privately owned is entirely coincidental. One good piece of news was that fares came down. This is from Friday the 29th of December. On January the 1st, the grouping system of the railways will come into effect, and with it a reduction of fares. Reduction will also be made in London Tramway and Omnibus fares, and on the Underground Railway system. So, in other words, the grouping and the reduction of fares are completely unconnected. The reason is that Britain is experiencing deflation at the moment. Prices are coming down. Even wages are coming down at the moment. You will see all sorts of negotiations, certainly with railway workers, to reduce their wages, which, you know, from our perspective seems bizarre, but that was what was going on in 1921. But then again, of course, your wages went further in those days, so it wasn't quite so bad. Anyway, it goes on. So far as the great railway companies are concerned, the general basis for third-class ordinary fares will be reduced to 1.5 pence a mile, and for first class to 2.5 pence a mile. Broadly speaking, this represents a reduction of 1/7 on the present fares and will bring them down to 50% above the pre-war basis instead of 75%. This brings us on to one of the bizarre elements, or to our modern sensibilities, seems one of the bizarre elements of railway fares in those days. They made no allowance for where the journeys were taking place. 1.5 pence per mile would be what you were paid in London or Liverpool or Leinster. You know, it was just standard across the country. There's no allowances for demand. No allowance for how much infrastructure, whether, you know, expensive tunnels were involved. No, it's just a straight fare. Also, there were no cheap fares, or very few. I mean, there were excursion trains. The sort of trains that would get people from the east end of London down to Kent to pick hops. There would be workmen's fares for people travelling slightly later in the morning, or sometimes a bit earlier. And, that was about it, really. Anyway, interestingly enough, the Times does publish some fares. This is what we have here is Paddington to Bristol, and this is then the first class fare is 48 shillings 10 pence. So, what does that how does that compare with modern fares? Well, 48 shillings is about 0.5 ounce of gold, which at today's rate is about £750. That sounds a lot of money. Having said that, the pound is clearly massively overvalued at the moment, and the Crozier fudge factor is to divide by 2, which would give us £375. What is the first class return fare from Paddington to Bristol at the moment? £340. Okay, well, they sound very similar. There are some differences. Modern trains are a lot faster. They're perhaps a bit more comfortable, in fact quite a lot more comfortable, and certainly safer. However, you do have to breathe in diesel fumes, and given a choice, I think I'd rather have coal smoke. The third class fare is 29 shillings and fourpence. That is very close, a third of an ounce of gold, which is about £500, and you divide by 2, get 250. Well, as it happens, today's fare is £240. So again, the price hasn't changed very much. You may be asking what's happened to second class. Well, there is no second class these days. What happened, second class has been abolished, or more accurately, what happened is first class fares and third class carriages has been abolished, and they just abolished the term second class, which is a bit odd, but that's how they've chosen to do things. One bit of good news is that there are some schemes on the horizon. This is again from Friday the 29th of December. In the discussions which have taken place on the tentative proposal to put in hand railway work and renewals, which are estimated to cost in round figures about £50 million, attention has been mainly devoted to the extent to which unemployment could be alleviated. I think it's worth pointing out here that at the moment we have high unemployment in Britain, and when I say the moment, 1922, they have a high unemployment, and that the Times is awash with schemes to to help out the unemployed, to reduce unemployment. And this always involves roads or railways. So these things are very, very common. He goes on. Proof has been given again and again that the changeover from steam to electrical operation enables a very much larger volume of passenger traffic to be handled and defers for many years the costly track widenings which would otherwise be the only remedy. Well, yes, electricity or electric trains allow you to run multiple units, which allows you to have cabs at either end and means you don't have to turn around locomotives at stations. Locomotives, steam locomotives, take something like 2 hours to actually get the boilers up to temperature, or into steam, as they call them, so they can go anywhere. Whereas electricity and later diesel multiple units could just start immediately. So, yeah, they're absolutely right about that. And track widenings, or indeed new railways, as we're finding out with HS2, are very expensive. It goes on. The schemes of the South Eastern and Chatham Company, of the Great Eastern Railway and of the Midland Railway for the conversion of a large mileage in the London area from steam to electricity are justified on this ground alone. Well, they might be justified, but did they happen? I mean, in the case of the South Eastern in Chatham, which was absorbed into the Southern Railway, yes, these things got, their lines got electrified very quickly. In the case of the Great Eastern, that didn't happen until, I think, 1949. And in the case of the Midland Railway, it didn't happen until 1983. So whatever the case may be, grouping certainly was not able to justify those schemes coming into existence. It goes on. One great advantage of electrification is that the slow-moving goods traffic, which is a nightmare to the men responsible for the operation of railway services, can be speeded up, or that the whole of the freight train services can be made to move at the same speed as the ordinary passenger train services, 30 miles an hour, so that all trains except passenger and special goods expresses would travel at the same rate. I'm interested to see that they have special goods expresses in those days. Anyway, as it happens, this doesn't happen. The truth is that the freight business, which is the main part of the railway business in 1922, is going to the wall, is slowly going to the wall. It will really get very serious in the 1950s, and by the 1960s, they don't quite abandon it. But certainly the mixed goods traffic just disappears. I mean, if you see a freight train nowadays, you'll notice it's will by and large be carrying the same good. It will be rails or coal or aggregates or maybe oil or something like that, which meant that there was no real prospect that electric goods services would ever come into existence. Not at that time. I mean, there are a few around, but very, very few. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this special. That's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.